Clodagh Walsh is here with the news in full.
The Minister for Transport, Tourism and Sport, Pascal Donoghue, has insisted that access and jobs would be core considerations in deciding whether or not the government sells its share in Aer Lingus. IAG, the parent group of British Airways, is offering just over €1.3 billion for the airline, of which the state owns a 25% stake. On RTE's primetime programme last night, Minister O'Donoghue said that any decision made on the future of Aer Lingus would have political consequences, and he acknowledged that the retention of slots at Heathrow Airport had to be considered.
All I have done in the past and would do again is be clear about what our current shareholding allows us to do in relation to slots. And what it does is bring us a long way towards the share of a vote that would be needed to block the disposal of a slot. And that is the situation at the moment. Our slots, and the slots of Aer Lingus, excuse me, because no state owns them, are fundamental to the access that we need. But there's other dimensions to it. Transatlantic access, our ability to trade with the east coast of America and beyond, is also hugely important to many companies here in Ireland.
At least 26 people have been killed in a series of attacks by Islamist militants in the north of Egypt's Sinai Peninsula. A car bomb and mortars hit military targets in the city of El Arish, killing a number of soldiers. Other attacks took place in nearby towns. A militant group linked to Islamic State said it carried out the attacks. The Egyptian authorities have been fighting an insurgency in the area since the ousting of President Mohamed Morsi in 2013. Cairo-based journalist Akram Shaban of the BBC's Arabic service gave details of the latest incidents.
We are actually talking about more than one attack, simultaneous attacks, which happened late on Thursday, after 2 hours after the curfew were in effect. And apparently the attacks involved a car bomb and mortar rounds as well, targeting a military base and police station facilities, and also about a dozen checkpoints.
A study on the amount of alcohol that college students consume has led to calls for further public policy measures to counter the risks to young people's health. The University College Cork study is published in the British Medical Journal today. It found a high prevalence of hazardous consumption among over 2,200 undergraduates who responded to the survey. The study has also found a narrowing of the gender gap, with hazardous consumption patterns now similar in men and women. Karen Creed reports.
This study puts the spotlight on Ireland's drinking culture among third-level students. The classroom research in University College Cork explored hazardous alcohol consumption, the consequences, and also focused on gender differences. Its findings showed a high prevalence of dangerous alcohol consumption among 66% of over 2,000 students who responded. It also showed a narrowing of the gender gap, with the consumption patterns now similar in men and women. At the higher end of the scale, approximately 17% of men and 5% of women were consuming more than 6 units of alcohol at least 4 times per week, in some cases on a daily basis. The study, which was led by PhD candidate Martin Davran, says it highlights the need for effective public policy measures such as a minimum unit price for alcohol.
The Fianna Fáil Senator Avril Power says new legislation being proposed will ensure e-cigarettes will be regulated in the same way as tobacco is. Senator Power and Senator and Professor John Crown are launching a bill to regulate the sale and marketing of e-cigarettes this morning. Speaking on this programme, Senator Power said there was currently no regulation at all on e-cigarettes. They could be sold to children and did not carry any health warnings. A man in his 30s is still being questioned in connection with the death of a man in South Belfast. The body of the man was discovered in Botanic Avenue early yesterday. He had been stabbed several times. Police, who've launched a murder investigation, believe the victim was originally from Pakistan. Police in the Netherlands say a man who forced his way into the studios of the national broadcaster and demanded to be put on air was carrying a fake gun. The 19-year-old was arrested without a struggle when armed police arrived. The incident in the city of Hilversum disrupted NOS television programming for about an hour. The American writer and musician Rod McKuen, who was known as the King of Kitsch, has died in California at the age of 81. He received 2 Oscar nominations, and some of his best-known songs were written with the Belgian composer Jacques Brel, including If You Go Away and Seasons in the Sun. And now the time is 8:05.
RTE Radio 1 weather with Grant Engineering. The Grant Vortex condensing oil boiler, providing super efficient, reliable and lower cost heating. Think boilers, think Grant.
It will be cold and breezy today with some frost and ice at first this morning. There will be a mix of bright spells and showers, with the showers mostly of rain or hail at lower levels, but they will turn wintry on higher ground. Highest temperatures of 4 to 7 degrees in fresh and gusty northwest winds. And there's a warning that northwest winds will reach gale force for a time this morning on all Irish coastal waters and on the Irish Sea.
That's what it says in today's papers.
Anne Enright's eloquent and powerful writing, fiercely individual voice and unyielding commitment to her craft combined to make her the preeminent choice. That was Taoiseach Enda Kenny yesterday naming Anne Enright as the inaugural laureate for Irish fiction. That report from Lawrence Mackin in the Irish Times. And on the role itself, Enright said, it's there to be made. The Arts Council and the committee see it as a sharpening of the kind of work that Irish writers are already engaged in, because you do an amount of cultivating the tradition one way or another. And a letter writer to the Times is also showing a literary streak this morning. Commenting on the verbal abuse aimed at the President, Brian Ahern from Dublin 15 says, I hope poetry will help Michael D. Higgins to see that the worst are full of passionate intensity. Then there's the Irish Daily Mail describing the snow as 50 shades of white. Now is the winter of our discontent, it says, and it's here for a while. Snow limits, says the Irish Daily Star, where Senan Hogan promises that the worst may be yet to come. Snow escape, says the Irish Daily Mirror. Ireland was last night warned to brace itself for an extreme wintry blast as snowstorms battled the country. Women now drink as much as men. That's the banner headline across the front of the Irish Examiner this morning. But read on, and it's a survey of college students by UCC PhD candidate Martin Daverin. Owen English says these findings have again led to calls for the government to reconsider a ban on sports alcohol sponsorship. Shatter asked for exclusion from Dáil inquiry is a headline for the Times. Fiach Kelly reporting that the former Minister for Justice, Alan Shatter, asked Ceann Comhairle, Sean Barrett, to exclude his handling of claims made by whistleblower Sergeant Maurice McCabe from an inquiry into allegations of Garda malpractice. The lead story for The Star from Patrick O'Connell says boxer Matthew Macklin has told of his terror after armed Gardaí raided an apartment he was staying in yesterday. It was like something you'd see in a film, he said. We were caught up in this completely innocently. I'm over here to take part in a charity gig. Nicky's million euro flop, says the Irish Sun. Ken Sweeney reporting that RTE is to revamp its million euro challenge game show after just 2 weeks and a loss of 200,000 viewers. Host Nicky Byrne has been praised for his presentation skills, but Montrose chiefs are desperate to find a new format to halt sliding ratings, it says. Another PPS bungle over Irish water is the lead story for the Mail, which says that PPS numbers will have to be handed over if families want to claim their €100 water conservation grant. Neil Michael says the government was last night accused of making this up as it goes along. The paper's editorial says the coalition has blundered aimlessly from one crisis to another, to another. The coalition also makes a lead for the Irish Independent, with Aer Lingus sale in jeopardy as coalition unease grows. It says the deal has been met with an extraordinary level of opposition from government TDs, and the paper's editorial concludes the national interest of the airline and the country as a whole will be better served by the government maintaining its stake in this vital piece of national infrastructure. Finally, wrong there, Michael, it's a pretty awful way to be judging women. That's Alison O'Connor in The Examiner, commenting on Deputy Michael Lowry's note to the Taoiseach, where he sought the reappointment of Valerie O'Reilly to the National Transport Authority. Why can't I simply dismiss it as harmless and something to be expected from men of that generation, she asks. And she goes on to argue for the importance of representing one half of the entire population of the country, the female half, in the Oireachtas, in boardrooms and in broadcasting. The Broadcasting Authority of Ireland supports a number of initiatives, she says, but in truth, we are simply throwing buns at elephants until we introduce a quota system for current affairs coverage. Until then, we'll keep freshening up the lipstick and wondering, did we simply miss the bus on the liposuction?
Valerie, thank you. Well, there's been much debate over recent days about the possible sale of Aer Lingus. Will it happen or will it not? Not if anything is to go by when reading the editorial in the Irish Independent this morning. The editor of the newspaper, Fionnán Sheehan, is on the line. Good morning.
Good morning, Fionn.
You're saying, Fionnán, this morning that Joan Burton was threatened with a revolt unless she blocked the sale.
Yeah, I mean, if you look back this time last week, we effectively knew that this... The formal bid was coming from IAG. It was expected at that stage that Aer Lingus' board would most likely accept it, and it would be then be rubber stamped by the government as a significant shareholder. Now you'd have to say that picture has substantially changed. The level of opposition within the coalition towards this move has intensified, and I think has taken senior ministers by quite a deal of surprise. It started last week and it has continued on and intensified as the week went on. You had two meetings of the Fine Gael parliamentary party dominated by this issue, and you have growing numbers of Labour Party backbenchers saying that this is in effect a red line issue for them. And you have seen more the cautious language that was emerging from cabinet level or on the week hardening as the week has gone on. So it seems to be broken down into two issues. One is the issue of Dublin and the large number of Aer Lingus jobs based at Dublin Airport, and that seems to be a main concern of predominantly Labour backbenchers on the north side of Dublin. And then when you go outside of Dublin, you're looking at along the western seaboard and in the southwest, so stretching from obviously Cork Airport, Shannon Airport, up to Knock, that there are severe reservations there about what exactly will happen to the connectivity to those regional airports once Aer Lingus is sold off. And they're not really buying it that there's going to be any sort of commitments coming from IAG about maintaining that level of connectivity. And there's concerns also both at the Dublin and regional levels about what exactly is going to happen to the Heathrow slot.
So what about the realities here, Fionnán? The fact that the government is a minority shareholder in this company anyway.
Yeah, but IAG have said quite clearly, Fran, that the takeover can only happen if it is sanctioned by government. They have said that they're not interested in a partial takeover, in effect, with the government maintaining its 25% shareholding. So they do need that level of improvement from the government side. And, you know, the Minister for Transport, Pascal Donoghue, has, you know, he's obviously had to be fair and balanced on this one, but you've seen as well that he himself has faced a strong level of opposition at meetings he has had to attend over the course of the week, but at the Fine Gael level and a special meeting of Labour Party backbenchers.
And perhaps
week.
A sense of that was in prime time last night. He was so cautious and so careful not to put a foot wrong.
Yeah, well, I mean, to be fair to him, he's in a difficult position. He has to weigh this up. I mean, his own officials are obviously looking at it quite closely. He has his own independent consultants looking at it. So, you know, you can't expect him to vary one way or the other at the moment. But certainly it is quite clear that the level of pressure politically that he is coming under is getting quite heavy at this stage. You're seeing language from the Taoiseach yesterday as well, where he was effectively saying that the government will have to take a wide range of considerations into play here. I think, you know, there was the notion, I think, last weekend coming from government that Willie Walsh, as the chief executive of IAG, would be aware of the political sensitivities here, obviously, with his own background being Irish and a former chief executive of Aer Lingus. you know, he'd know what was going to be required to push this across the line. I don't think that's holding a whole lot of sway on the backbenches. Ultimately, people know that, you know, his primary duty is going to be to IAG and to its shareholders. So there does seem to be a realisation that any commitments that are made in that regard aren't going to be a whole lot of use down the line if IAG decides to take strategic decisions that would result perhaps in the removal of some of the Heathrow slots from direct connections to Ireland, or indeed scaling down their level of activities of Aer Lingus at, say, Cork or Shannon Airport.
And commercial decisions, they'll want value if they pay out 1.3 or 1.4 billion euro. But when you hear people like Labour TD Brendan Ryan saying that he's instinctively against it, and a lot of people on the Labour side are using that kind of language, do you get the sense that this is a serious enough issue that if Cabinet or Government was to vote and approve a sale, that this could be a real sticking point for the coalition?
Yeah, I mean, to be fair to a guy like Brendan, there's a iteration here. I mean, his brother Sean, who was a previous TD, has lost the party whip over related Aer Lingus issue in previous administrations. So, you know, I wouldn't for one moment underestimate the level of emotion that would be attached to this issue from somebody like him. I think the primary problem as well that you're going to have is the proximity of a general election. I don't really think that if you're a Labour Party TD who has already seen the party's support plummeting quite dramatically, you're really not going to want to go knocking on doors of constituencies on the north side of Dublin and the North County, where Aer Lingus is such a substantial employer and where Dublin Airport is such a substantial employer, by saying, yeah, you know what, we've sold off Aer Lingus, we didn't need to do it on financial grounds, we did it on strategic grounds, but we're accepting that there is a level of risk here and we're entering into the unknown. That's just too much when you're into effectively a general election year.
All right, Fionnán Sheehan, editor of the Irish Independent, thank you for that.
In Ireland, if you're a gay man, you're not allowed to donate blood. Recently, Health Minister Leo Varadkar said he wanted to remove the blanket ban and introduce a 12-month deferral. In other words, lifting the ban on donations from gay men if they're sexually inactive for a year, a move which the Irish Haemophilia Society has raised concerns over. We'll be speaking to the CEO of the society shortly. But first, Louise Byrne has been meeting some of those directly affected by the blood donation ban.
There's someone out there right now who needs you.
The advertisements from the Irish Blood Transfusion Service have a simple message.
They share your blood type, making you both blood buddies.
This recent campaign appealed for blood buddies, but not if you're a gay man.
Your blood buddies will be there to give blood to you. Will you be there for them too? Become a blood buddy today.
The Health Minister, Leo Varadkar, is considering lifting the lifetime ban on gay men donating blood and has said he favours allowing those who have not had sex for 12 months to donate. Others, including those in long-term monogamous relationships, will remain excluded. Men like Stephen Hatton, a medical student in Trinity College Dublin, who recently tried to give blood.
I went in, I went to Dalier Street, and I went in and asked for the form. I said I'd like to give blood, knowing that I wouldn't be allowed. So I went through the whole application, the whole screening process, and I handed it back in. Being completely honest, they said that I was ineligible because of my sexual history, and I asked what part, and they said, well, this criteria here, you know, man who has sex with men, MSM, means that you're not allowed to give blood. And I asked why, and they kind of said there's a risk to the blood supply of transmitted infections. I said, that's interesting, is it the same with other people? They said, well, you know, it got a bit awkward then. I'd had enough, so I left, shaken up and upset. I like to think of myself as, you know, a positive asset to public health, let's say. You know, that's what I'm going into. I like to think of myself as someone who can improve public health. But with this ban, I have this conflict where I'm actually told I'm a threat to public health.
Dr. William Murphy is the medical and scientific director of the Irish Blood Transfusion Service. He supports changes to the current policy and says as blood sterilising technology improves, the ban on gay men donating could be completely lifted within 5 years.
They're expensive technologies and they're not completely risk-free, but they may well represent a route in the future. So whatever decision we make now should just be part of a process and a continuing dialogue into the future, because we should be able to crack this problem.
You mentioned a 4 or 5 year timeline. Is that realistic for Ireland?
Well, yes, I think it is.
There is no such blanket ban on gay men donating organs, although sexual history is considered, and the Irish Blood Transfusion Service does import blood from countries where gay men are allowed to donate.
For rare blood groups. So there will be people whom we can't get a matched donor for in this population, and we bring in blood usually from the UK, sometimes from Sweden, sometimes from the USA, where in the UK particularly, the ban is different. So yes, we do accept a ban of or a deferral period of 1 year for UK blood donors.
HIV is increasing among gay men in Ireland, who accounted for 46% of new diagnoses last year. But as HIV can be detected by current blood screening around a week after infection, Robert Milling, who is a 22-year-old gay man, says the 12-month deferral is excessive.
I think a 12-month deferral period is very, very long time. Like, you see advertisements on the television and everywhere that blood is always needed and donate blood and I have an organ donor card and stuff like that. And then you're told, as a gay man, you can't. You're just not allowed, ever. It's quite upsetting. It makes you feel different to everyone else, considering they are looking for it actively and then they're just like, no, thank you.
Stephen Hatton feels that at the heart of the problem is that gay men are not trusted to be honest about their sexual history.
I'm automatically told you are high risk or above. You are high risk because either you have HIV, we're going to assume that, we're going to assume you have a strong likelihood to, or we're going to assume you're going to lie on the form. You can talk through all of these questions and be assessed comprehensively if you're straight, but not if you're a man who's sex with men.
That's Stephen Hatton ending that report by Louise Byrne. Brian O'Mahony, CEO of the Irish Haemophilia Society, is here. Brian, thanks for coming in to us. Just first of all, what is haemophilia and why are haemophiliacs so dependent on blood donations?
Well, haemophilia is an inherited bleeding disorder where the blood doesn't clot properly. And there are over 1,000 people in Ireland with haemophilia or von Willebrand's disease or rare bleeding disorders. The treatment for haemophilia can be synthetic products, but very often blood products as well. So people with haemophilia in the past have been exposed to a lot of blood products. It's actually, for von Willebrand's and rare bleeding disorders, it's the standard routine treatment. They get treated very, very frequently. And the reason that this is a big issue for us, of course, is because, ironically, people with haemophilia are also deferred as blood donors, but people with haemophilia have suffered more than anybody else in the country in the past from unsafe blood. And in the past 30 years, since 1985, 116 people with haemophilia in Ireland have died. 112 of those, or 97%, died from unsafe blood. Only 4 died from haemophilia.
The blood and the blood products that you and other haemophiliacs receive, how is it screened?
Well, for routine treatment of haemophilia now, you use synthetic products. But for many of the other products, they're actually virally inactivated. So they're plasma-derived medicinal products. But people with haemophilia will still need blood or plasma more frequently than other members of the general population. Yes, it is screened. Blood donations are always screened. But of course, the primary responsibility of a blood transfusion service is the safety of patients who get blood. And the whole purpose of deferral is to minimise the risk of transfusion-transmitted infections from blood donations and from blood pools.
You want a ban on gay men donating blood to remain. Why?
We believe that any change in donor deferral for any category of people should be based on scientific evidence. What we're saying is that, and it's not just gay men, by the way, who are deferred. People with haemophilia are deferred, their spouses are deferred, UK residents are deferred, blood recipients are deferred, people who ever injected drugs even once in their life are deferred.
Yes, but we're talking about this particular ban.
Yes, but the same principle applies to all deferrals. If the deferral can be changed based on scientific evidence without increasing the risk to the safety of the blood supply, then it's acceptable. If the deferral change means an increased risk to the blood supply, it's not acceptable.
What's the risk?
The risk is that there are two main categories of risk. One is the risk from known viruses such as HIV, hepatitis B or hepatitis C.
Are they not screened for?
They are screened for, but probably the bigger risk is new infectious agents, which, if they're in donors, can spread to recipients before the agents are actually recognised and before there's a screening test for them.
But new infectious agents could come from anybody. Why gay men?
New infectious agents. Gay men are one of the categories of people, along with people with haemophilia, along with UK residents, who are categories of people at higher risk for transfusion-transmitted infections.
What will be the increase to the risk if this ban is lifted, or more to the point, if the ban is lifted as is suggested with the 12-month deferral?
Well, look, what we're saying is that the Blood Transfusion Service have put forward a number of options to the Minister.
Yes.
A lifetime deferral, a 5-year deferral, a 1-year deferral, a no deferral. We're very happy to engage with the Minister and the Department to discuss this, and we want the decision to be made based purely on the science.
Yes, but on the science, what will the risk be increased by if the ban is lifted or if it's deferred by 12 months?
Well, according to
the
report from the Blood Transfusion Service and the options they've given to the department, if the deferral is removed altogether, then you look at a doubling of the risk of HIV. If it's one year, it doesn't give you adequate protection against unknown agents. And if it's 5 years, they actually state that a deferral of 5 years in the past would not have protected people against HIV or hepatitis C.
The UK has lifted their ban with a 12-month deferral, no change to risk. Australia, the same, no change. Ireland imports blood from countries with more relaxed regimes, so without wishing to put it crudely, the blood of gay men is already in our system. Yes?
Well, you know, the fact that Germany, France, Denmark, Norway and Netherlands have not changed and still maintain a lifetime deferral is actually true. Also, there was an increased risk in Australia. When they've actually looked at the figures, there was an increased risk. There was an increased number of HIV positive donations in Australia.
I'm looking at an Australian study here. No evidence of significantly increased of transfusion-transmitted human immunodeficiency virus infection in Australia. Subsequent to implementing a 12-month deferral for men who have had sex with men. The point is, this blood is already in our system and we've had no change.
Actually, if you look at the report from the IBTS, the Department of Health, it points out that there have been an increase in the number of HIV-positive donations in Australia.
We found no evidence that the implementation of the 12-month deferral for male-to-male sex resulted in an increased recipient risk for HIV in Australia. People who aren't gay men donate blood, who engage in the same sexual practices that you say are a risk worthy of a ban. People who aren't gay men donate blood and may have shared needles, had unprotected sex with infected partners. You're still depending on honest disclosure from donors, irrespective of who they are, and good screening from blood authorities. Why single out gay men, or more to the point, sex between two men?
Look, I appreciate the views of Stephen and the other people on the programme there, and I understand that if we could get rid of this deferral, there would be a societal benefit. But the fact is that donors are deferred, categories of people are deferred because there's an increased risk of transfusion-transmitted infection. Now, I'm absolutely fine with any change once the scientific evidence shows that that doesn't increase the risk of the blood supply. When we engage with the Minister and the Department on this, if they can show scientifically that this will not increase the risk of the blood supply, we're happy with that.
But this must be based on scientific evidence. Increase the risk, do you?
Well, there's strong evidence that it will, and that
do
comes
you have any evidence that a 12-month deferral will increase the risk?
There is strong evidence that that may increase the risk, and that
Where?
Comes from the Irish Blood Transfusion paper to the Department of Health.
No, they say a lifetime ban may double a risk that's already small. They don't give any evidence for what effect a 12-month deferral ban will have.
They clearly state that a 12-month deferral would not protect you against any new infectious agent in the blood supply. And new infectious agents come along all the time. I'll remind you that in the last number of years, we've had hepatitis E, variant CJD, H1N1, H5N1,
okay.
SARS, West Nile, Ebola and XMRV. Some of those have been capable of being transmitted by blood. Now, the fact is that it's not so much HIV we're worried about, it's a new infectious agent in the blood supply.
From all people, not just gay men having sex, yes?
We're very happy to see a change in deferral if it doesn't increase the risk to the blood supply. That has to be the only consideration.
Brian O'Mahony, CEO of the Irish Haemophilia Society. Thank you very much.
Des is back with sport.
Yeah, and good news as well, because Graham McDowell is now sharing the lead at the top of the leaderboard in the Dubai Desert Classic. He's picked up 7 shots so far today, 8 birdies and 1 bogey. He's played 17 holes and he's on 12 under par alongside Danny Willett. Peter Lawrie shot 69. He's finished on 2 under. That's 1 shot inside the projected cut. The other Irish players have yet to begin their rounds. Rory McIlroy on 6 under. Damien McGrain 1 under. Michael Hoey level par. And Darren Clark is 1 over. Meanwhile, in the US, Tiger Woods had a bit of a nightmare start on his first round of 2015. He was 4 over par after 4 holes in the Phoenix Open. He was 5 over after 12, but he recovered to finish on 2 over par. But that still left him 9 shots behind the leader, Ryan Palmer, on 7 under. Padraig Harrington is level after 17 holes when play was stopped because of darkness. And Harrington holed out from 161 yards from the rough for an eagle 2 to get back to level par on that hole. Now, in tennis, defending champion Stan Wawrinka and world number one Novak Djokovic are going head-to-head now for a place in the Australian Open final. The pair meet at the tournament for a third year in succession. Both meetings ended in five-set epics previously, and each of the winners of those games went on to lift the championship trophy. Andy Murray awaits the winner. Well, the big action in Ireland today is the rugby clash of the Irish Wolfhounds and the England Saxons in Cork this evening. The match is live on RT2. It features Sean O'Brien starting in an Ireland shirt for the first time in 14 months after shoulder surgery. Keith Earls also returns after injury at centre. The only uncapped player in the starting 15 is Jack Conan at number 8. Gordon Darcy is named. He's been telling Justin Tracy about the opportunity this game presents to the players.
You know, you're fresh in the mind of the coaches, you perform well, and we know what Joe is looking for. He's looking for guys to make the players around them look well, and look, you know, playing for each other and doing your job role very, very well. So, like, you're fresh in the mind of the coaches week before selection for the first Six Nations game. So, like, literally, you know, all the cliches apply, and it's all there to be played for.
How's training gone as a kind of a new group of players? Comes together, the likes of Jack Conan in for the first time, Ian Henderson coming back, as you mentioned, is the first time yourself and Keith would have played now in nearly 4 years. There's a lot of kind of combinations that have, I suppose, ground to make up, a lot to get used to in a very short time. How's that gone?
I think you're relying on quality there, and all the names you mentioned are quality, and they deliver, have delivered in recent weeks in pressure situations. So you were kind of, it's a short week. You know, Joe has what he wants to get through, and Dan has what he wants to get through, and there's, you know, maybe a little bit more time on your feet than you want. But yeah, like, it's not really something that can enter into your head. You know, you take what's given. You know, it's going to be a short combination week, but you're just, you know, the guys that Keith Earls had a fantastic return to rugby. So did Hendy, and you know, I'm just looking after my own shop and trying to put my best foot forward. And I know that if I do kind of my job well, and Earlsy does his, and you know, that kind of filters across the team, and everybody just looks after their own little individual jobs and individual roles, and does that well. You know, that'll go a long way.
That's Gordon Darcy. Now, also this weekend, the GAA season kicks off in full with the Allianz Football League getting underway. Kildare opened their campaign against Down, and Brian Carthy has been talking to Kildare manager Jason Ryan about the high expectations.
The expectations are massive, but I suppose expectations come along with a few positive results. You know, you have a few positive results at the start of the year, in the middle of the year, and all of a sudden you can often forget about what happened last month or in the previous 6 months. As a management team, we're very realistic, and we know that we are in the middle of a building phase, that we want to become a team that, regardless of who we're playing against in Ireland, that we're competitive. And last year would have shown that against a number of the teams, we've a bit of work to do. Now, whether that's because we had so many players that were missing, or whether it was a case that we, as a management team, got things wrong tactically, or whether it was a case that those teams really are just that little bit ahead of us, talent-wise and experience-wise, who knows. But what we are, I suppose, what we do know and what we are in control of is the players, when they're fit and well, and we're all working together as a group, we can really progress and we can really improve. And I suppose the lead up to our last round of the qualifiers against Monaghan was a testament to that as a group they worked really, really hard at trying to improve how we played, our style of play, and various aspects of our performance. And in that Monaghan game, we played probably our best football of the whole year last year.
In the Fitzgibbon Cup games, there were wins for Cork IT, UCD, UL, UCC, Waterford and Limerick IT. Now in football, the Liverpool manager Brendan Rodgers will decide today if Daniel Sturridge will play in tomorrow's game against West Ham. Sturridge admits he's anxious and excited as he prepares to return from 5 months out injured.
It's been very frustrating for myself, but you know, it's all a learning curve in terms of these experiences allow you to learn something new. And for me, you know, it's been great from a mental side of the game. I've improved that, and you know, as I said, I'm looking forward to getting back out there. I'm very, very anxious to be out there. As they say, I'm chomping at the bit. That's the only thing for me, just to be playing.
Why go the wrong way round?
Kind of. In the one-day cricket international, England 25 for 1 in reply to India's total of 200 from 48.1 overs. In racing, Ruby Walsh rode his 50th winner of the season. In snowy conditions at Thurles, he guided the Willie Mullins trained Totally Dominant to victory in the 2 mile maiden hurdle. And this evening's racing action is in Dundalk at 5:35.
Des, thank you. The voice that you heard there during the sports bulletin was that of Kenneth Clark, who's sitting opposite me now, a cabinet minister in British governments for over 20 years, 3 times contender for the leadership of the Conservative Party, but never actually succeeded. Still an MP and still hoping to be an MP after the next general election, which is going to be this year. You're very welcome to Morning Ireland.
No, pleasure to be here. Sorry, I barracked your sports bulletin.
Not at all. We always welcome interruptions during that particular part of the programme. You're in Dublin today to argue for the merits of Britain staying within the EU should it be put to a referendum by David Cameron, he says, if he wins the next general election. What was your reaction when he first announced he was going to do this?
Yeah, I'm here with European Movement Ireland because I think there's a big Irish interest in what on earth the British are going to do. And my reaction when it was first announced a referendum was disappointment. I mean, I was surprised. I'm of a generation that's not in favour of referendums.
I heard you were appalled, no?
Well, I prefer parliamentary democracy. Referendums are a way of trying to get... I know you have them constitutionally in Ireland, but I would rather avoid them in Britain. I'd like to be able to hold people accountable for the continuing effects of their decisions rather than have dramatic yes-no questions being asked from now and again, which pose more questions than they answer normally. But anyway, quite apart from that, it does mean that I hope not too much uncertainty comes into our membership. My opinion, Britain's role in the world, if we're to look after our interests and be a beneficial influence, I hope, in all those parts of the world where we have interests to protect, is as a leading member of the European Union. And our economy is totally dependent on our, not only on our being in the single market, but able to play a part in the Council and framing the rules and so on, and taking part in trade negotiations with the Americans and all this kind of thing. And I think the days of Lord Palmerston have gone. More relevantly, up to date, Britain on its own would be diminished, lest the Americans would find us a less valuable ally, the Russians would take very little notice of us, and we work better with the other European states when we take a collective view. It stops us fading away compared with all the new powers in the world.
You say that Britain needs to bear in mind Ireland in a vote over EU membership. Do you think it is bearing us in mind? Do you think it cares?
Well, I regret no, but to be fair, I think the public as a whole, as compared with the political and journalist class, you know, the bubble, are not really engaged in this very much at all. And if we do have a referendum, there's going to have to be a much more intense debate when we get there. I mean, in my opinion, obviously...
Do you really think Ireland's going to be part of that debate?
Well, I think that what consequences does this have? Because Ireland's not going to leave the European Union, I would imagine. It's not for me to say, but it strikes me as completely crazy for the Irish Republic to leave the European Union. Half your modernisation, the future of your recovery, rather depends on the role you play, a very strong role, inside the European economy. Now, we've got the best relations with the Irish Republic since Irish independence at the moment. We have a peace process in Northern Ireland. We have a border which is not strictly, you know, it doesn't have to be strictly barricaded and manned. We have a good flow, we have free flow of goods and services over it. If the Britain were to leave the European Union and the Republic were to stay in the European Union, presumably that means the British are going to start doing things which distinguish them and their economy and their politics from the rest of Europe, and then
just
if you could
drop a bilateral arrangement with Ireland, which is probably what.
Well, Eurosceptics seem to imagine we could have a bilateral arrangement with 28 member states, and that would be more convenient, apparently, than actually playing a part.
But it'd be fairly straightforward to do it with the one nearest to you, surely.
It ought to be. It would have to be. You'd have to negotiate some understanding. But if we suddenly decided that now we were no longer in the EU, we wish to have some different consumer protection regulations, some food safety regulations, some different environmental standards, and that's what all the European regulations are about, quite how do you enforce that either side of the border. And if you do start putting in difficulties in the border, I think you will have an unsettling effect on the settlement in Ulster, and it won't be in the interests of either the Irish or the British.
What about if Northern Ireland votes yes to stay in the EU? If Scotland votes yes to stay in the EU, but England says no, is that going to lead to a breakup of the UK?
I think having held a referendum on Scotland, it has increased the prospects of the Union breaking up. I mean, the result was in favour of the Union, but it's caused all kinds of constitutional questions to be thrown up. And whenever you lose it, anybody who loses a referendum immediately claims it's all a deceit of the electorate. They've been deceived. So that means the Scotnats have sort of angling for another referendum within 5 minutes of the last one closing. If Scotland, where there's no great Euroscepticism, if Scotland were to vote for staying in the Union, England was to vote for going out and to take the UK
and
out.
Northern Ireland was to vote to stay in the Union.
Well, Northern Ireland's different. Can you envisage Northern Ireland ever coming to a political conclusion that it was going to be a totally independent, separate Ulster in the world? I think the Northern Ireland will stay with the United Kingdom because the political difficulties of reopening all that would cause real chaos for the particular Northern Irish.
But if they
problem.
Voted to stay
Scotland,
yes,
Scotland,
EU,
I think you will
no.
really pose a serious risk of finishing the Union off if Scotland found it was being taken out of the European Union, despite its vote in a referendum by the English.
Can you understand why many want to leave the EU? They blame it for all their problems, especially in the UK in the case of immigration. But for many, even in this country too, the EU has made, some people would argue, a mess of things economically, so perhaps it's best to be rid of it.
No, I think it's, that given that the terribly difficult times are in, worst financial crisis of my lifetime and all the rest of it, the people are looking for simple explanations, and blaming foreigners, blaming the EU, blaming Brussels is a lot easier than sorting out the financial and economic mess that our politicians have tended to get us all in the recent past with the help of our bankers and other people. So that is what in Britain what lies behind it. And the hardline Eurosceptics have a simple solution to every problem we have of low pay, housing, health pressures and so on. It's immigrants, it's foreigners, it's Brussels, and it's all the immigrants. And that's you know, not doing justice to the more intelligent Eurosceptic case, but it does, explain a lot of the feeling. Most members of the public have a limited understanding of exactly how the European Union works. But Ireland, for example, and the United Kingdom, most of our problems were caused by a crazy credit bubble and credit crash. Your housing market was an even bigger mania than the British housing market. Your banks collapsed before ours did. You were the first ones to nationalise your debt. Actually, none of that had anything to do with the EU or Brussels. And I don't think most of the present problems of the Eurozone have anything to do with the euro. Those problems are caused by politicians in various countries not following the rules which the finance ministers of my generation, including the Irish and the British, laid down for how the euro was supposed to work.
Let's go to the other extremity of the EU. You warned some time ago that Greece would face disaster if they voted for, and I'm using your own quote here, cranky extremists. Have they, and what now?
I'm not sure I called them that. I mean, I'm very nostalgic when I look at the Greek situation. They remind me of the student Trotskyites of my youth. Greece has voted. I think Greece has voted in despair at its political establishment. In most countries, people are angry with their political establishment. Greece has gone. I think they've just taken the risk, the chance that anything must be better. And we wait to see what Syriza will do. And they've started off in a very worrying way. I think Grexit is, Greeks leaving the Eurozone could be catastrophic for the Greeks, make their terrible experiences of the last few years even worse. I trust that common sense will prevail in negotiating some ordered, reasoned arrangement, but I don't envy the task of those going to have to negotiate it. But we now have this vote down. It's a pure protest vote, and you have left-wing, rather populist politicians with whom you've got to try to negotiate a settlement.
Just before I let you go, because we were talking earlier in the programme about e-cigarettes, I know this is a complete move, but and a bid to regulate their sale here, because you were deputy.
I stick to cigars myself.
You were deputy chairman and director of one of the world's giant tobacco companies, British American Tobacco. Are you still involved with them?
No, I can't be. I had to give it up when I became a shadow minister and a minister. I haven't gone back. I was for a time.
The reason I ask you is because they're selling.
Who make e-cigarettes.
Yes, they're selling e-cigarettes and they're spending millions of pounds developing e-cigarettes. Why?
Well, because there's a market for them. There's a tremendous campaign to stop people smoking cigarettes for health reasons, and there are some very valid.
Why does a company that makes cigarettes want to invest money in a product that is helping people, they believe, to come off
cigarettes? Because it's the same market. I mean, their market's under attack from the makers of nicotine patches. It's the same reason people make nicotine patches. And I always tell myself I'm not addicted to nicotine, and if I am enjoying the nicotine, I enjoy my cigars for other reasons. People who find socially that it's attractive, that they can get satisfaction out of e-cigarettes, and there's less health hazards in e-cigarettes, want to give up smoking because of the health hazards. E-cigarettes is obviously regarded by many people as an attractive alternative. It's a market. It's not a decision I was involved in because I left about 6 years ago. But they're going into e-cigarettes. Personally, if I was the kind of smoker who just couldn't imagine life without my cigarette, I'd go to an e-cigarette rather than keep buying ridiculous patches to stick on my arm with the nicotine. But that's probably my entering into what is now a market competition, which is no concern of mine. I'm a customer for cigars. Nowadays.
Kenneth Clark, thank you very much for coming into our studio this morning.
Next to a Cork man in London, an artist whose painting Dance with the Devil has sold for more than €100,000. Conor Harrington, good morning.
Good morning, Fran. Good morning, Ireland.
Tell us about Dance with the Devil, Conor.
Dance with the Devil. It's a painting that I did a couple of years ago, and I hung on to it for myself. Normally, most of the paintings that I do are exhibited, but another artist friend of mine advised me a few years ago that I should hang on to some of my work kind of for the future, you know. So the Bonhams got in touch with me and asked me if I was interested in putting a piece into auction. So I decided to put that piece in.
Now,
first time I've done it.
Bonhams, a very prominent seller on a very prominent street in London, and they have given you tremendous prominence even in their catalogue.
Yeah, I mean the whole. I'm new to the whole kind of to the auction system, I suppose. I've been working here in London as an artist for the last 10 years, and it's always been kind of through galleries and stuff. So the whole auction house thing is a very new process for me. So when they got in touch and said that they'd do a 10-page section in the catalogue and all that, it seemed very appealing.
Now, I've tweeted a picture, an image from the catalogue of the picture. It is highly detailed and complex. Where does the inspiration for something like that come from somebody who grew up in Bishopstown and has been painting all his life?
It's kind of hard to say where the inspiration for that particular painting came from, as it's part of a greater body of work that I've been doing over the last few years. So what I do to start off the whole process is I do a photo shoot where I get models and actors in. So everything that's in that painting was in a photograph. So I got those guys in. They're both actors, and I dressed them up in costumes and hired all the props that's in the background that are in the background, and take a photo and then start the painting process from there.
Excellent. Well, Conor, unfortunately, we're out of time. I'd love to have more time to talk to you, but we may well speak to you sometime again. It's fair to say things are going well for you in London. So thanks very much for speaking to us this morning.
Okay, thanks very much, friend.